Hello, and welcome to Activists Connect, a podcast seeking to engage, educate, and entertain to connect amnesty activists across the country. I'm Isabella.
And I'm Tiana. And I would like to begin by acknowledging the Yuggera and Turrbal people as the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting in Brisbane. And I would like to extend my respects to elders past, present, and emerging from wherever you are listening from, and acknowledge that this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Next month, on the 10th of December, marks a major milestone in the history of human rights. This milestone is the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
So to celebrate this milestone, we thought it would be the perfect time to do an episode on the history of the human rights movement and the birth of Amnesty International.
This 70th anniversary of the Declaration is also an opportunity to celebrate our successes and recommit ourselves to the principles outlined in the Declaration's 30 articles.
6 months later, I published an article in The Observer called The Forgotten Prisoners.
I have a dream!
When I first got involved, some things are still the same, but we focus on letter writing.
For the first time, Australia has recognised the legal existence of Aborigines prior to white settlement.
Throughout history, when people referred to rights, there were two types of rights that they were referring to: natural rights and legal rights. The idea of human rights is closely related to that of natural rights. Natural rights are generally considered to exist beyond the authority of any government or international body to dismiss. Natural rights were traditionally viewed exclusively as negative rights, whereas human rights today also comprise of positive rights. A negative right is one that requires others to abstain from interfering with your actions, whereas positive rights require others to provide you with a good or a service. The concept of natural rights comes from the concept of natural law. Natural law is a philosophy asserting that humans have certain rights inherent by virtue of human nature. These rights are considered to be endowed by nature, or traditionally by a god or transcendent source, and they can be understood universally through human reason. Throughout a lot of history, while many ancient civilizations, like the cities of the ancient Near East and civilizations of ancient Egypt, supported basic human rights, there was no official doctrine to determine any moral or legal entitlements that people had. Then, in 539 BC, Cyrus the Great, after conquering the city of Babylon, did something totally unexpected. He freed all slaves to return home, and he declared that people should be free to choose their own religion. These rights were inscribed into the Cyrus Cylinder, a clay tablet containing his statements, which was the first human rights declaration in history. After this, the idea of human rights spread pretty quickly to India, Greece, and eventually Rome.
The next important advance in the history of human rights was the establishment of the Magna Carta, also known as the Great Charter. In 1215, after King John of England violated a number of ancient laws and customs by which England had been governed, his subjects forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which catalogues what later came to be thought of as human rights. Among them was the right of the church to be free from governmental interference, the rights of all free citizens to own and inherit property, and to be protected from excessive taxes. It established the right of widows who own property to choose not to remarry, and established principles of due process and equality before the law. It also contained provisions forbidding bribery and official misconduct. Widely viewed as one of the most important legal documents in the development of modern democracy, the Magna Carta is a crucial turning point in the struggle to establish freedom.
The modern human rights movement was shaped by doctrines like the Petition of Right, which in 1628 set out the rights of people. It was one of England's most famous constitutional documents, written by Parliament as an objection to the overreach of authority by King Charles I. During his reign, citizens saw his overreach of authority as a major infringement of their civil rights.
On July 4, 1776, the United States Congress approved the Declaration of Independence. Its primary author, Thomas Jefferson, wrote the Declaration as a formal explanation of why Congress had voted on July 2nd to declare independence from Great Britain, more than a year after the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War, and as a statement announcing that the 13 American colonies were no longer a part of the British Empire. Philosophically, the Declaration stressed two themes: individual rights and the right of revolution. These ideas became widely held by Americans and spread internationally as well, influencing in particular the French Revolution.
In 1789, during the French Revolution, France's National Constituent Assembly set the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, stating that all citizens are equal under the law.
In April 1945, delegates from 50 allied nations met in San Francisco for the United Nations Conference on International Organization. The goal of the conference was to fashion an international body to promote peace and prevent future wars. The ideals of the organization were stated in the preamble to its proposed charter.
We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind.
The charter of the new United Nations organization went into effect on October 24, 1945, a date that is celebrated each year as United Nations Day. By 1948, the United Nations new Human Rights Commission had captured the world's attention. Under the dynamic chairmanship of Eleanor Roosevelt, the commission set out to draft the document that became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Roosevelt, credited with its inspiration, referred to the declaration as the International Magna Carta for all mankind. It was adopted by the United Nations on December 10, 1948. The member states of the United Nations pledged to work together to promote the 30 Articles of Human Rights that, for the first time in history, had been assembled and codified into a single document. In consequence, many of these rights, in various forms, are today part of the constitutional laws of democratic nations.
So, in many cases, people will take legal action when their human rights are being violated. And here in Australia, there have been several landmark human rights cases brought before a judge, and Australia's federal discrimination law has come a long way over the years. With the commencement of the Racial Discrimination Act in 1975, the Sex Discrimination Act in 1984, the Disability Discrimination Act in 1992, and the Age Discrimination Act in 2004. Interpreting and applying anti-discrimination legislation remains one of the most complex areas of Australian law, and without a Bill of Rights, it's also one of the most crucial areas of Australian law. In recent years, a number of important cases decided by Australian courts have set important precedents for the recognition of human rights in Australia, and we thought we'd talk about a few of these in this episode.
The Mabo vs. Queensland case of the 1980s was a landmark human rights case and arguably one of the most significant cases of racial discrimination in Australian history. The case was opened in 1982 when Eddie Mabo, a Torres Strait Islander man, challenged the Queensland government for land ownership in the Torres Strait. Before the High Court had considered Eddie Mabo's claims that he had native title over his traditional lands in the Torres Strait, the Queensland government passed a law extinguishing all native title in Queensland. The High Court found that, on the assumption that Indigenous people did have title to their traditional land, the Queensland law was discriminatory because it took away property rights from Indigenous people and not from anybody else. The Mabo case ran for 10 years. On the 3rd of June 1992, the High Court of Australia decided that terra nullius, which is Latin for nobody's land, should not have been applied to Australia.
At the heart of today's ruling, a 10-year battle by the Meriyan people of the Murray Islands in the Torres Strait for recognition of their traditional rights to the island. The Queensland government tried to take those rights away. The islanders took the government to court. Today, the High Court in Canberra ruled the Meriyan people are entitled to possession, occupation, use and enjoyment of the island, effectively recognising their native title.
This decision recognised that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have rights to their land, rights that existed before the British arrived and can still exist today. The Mabo decision was a turning point for the recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's rights because it acknowledged their unique connection with the land and was the first time Australia recognised the legal existence of Indigenous Australians prior to white settlement. It also led to the Australian Parliament passing the Native Title Act in 1993.
One of Australia's landmark sex discrimination cases was in 1998 when Maria Hickey, a contract partner with a Sydney law firm, Hunt & Hunt, brought a complaint against her employer after her request to work part-time following the birth of her child was refused. She claimed that the firm had given away her client base while she was on maternity leave. And in a complaint heard by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, now the Australian Human Rights Commission, Commissioner Evatt found that the law firm had indirectly discriminated against Ms. Hickey by requiring her to work full-time in order to maintain her practice. The firm was ordered to pay $95,000 in compensation, and the case highlighted the importance of employers putting in flexible working arrangements.
Unlike most other liberal democracies, Australia has no Bill of Rights to protect human rights in a single document. Rather, rights may be found in the Constitution, common law, and legislation. International organisations such as Amnesty play an integral role in keeping governments accountable and ensuring that everyone's rights are upheld.
The story of Amnesty International began almost 60 years ago with one man, Peter Benenson, a British lawyer who was outraged after reading an article in the newspaper.
It was on the 19th of November 1960. I was sitting on the tube reading a newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, when one particular paragraph caught my attention. It related how two Portuguese students had been sentenced to terms of imprisonment for no other offence than having drunk a toast to liberty in a restaurant in Lisbon. This was during the dark days of the Salazar regime. Perhaps because I'm particularly attached to the concept of liberty, perhaps because I'm fond of wine myself, this news item produced a righteous indignation in me that transcended normal bounds. 6 months later, I published an article in The Observer called The Forgotten Prisoners, which was reprinted simultaneously in many of the world's influential papers. As I remember, that article began with these words: "Open your newspaper any day of the week and you will find a report from somewhere in the world of someone being imprisoned, tortured, or executed because his opinions are unacceptable to his government."
Benenson had an idea about how this problem could be solved. Together with a number of others who shared his view, Benenson organised, in the years that followed, the movement which is known today as Amnesty International. The great and ambitious goal of this organisation was to contribute to the implementation in every country of the principles of the Declaration of Human Rights. In doing so, Peter Benenson gave life to the vision of collective action that defines Amnesty International's work today. Amnesty International utilises the power of grassroots campaigning and organising, harnessing collective action from the local level to effect change at the local, regional, national, or international level. Grassroots movements are defined by their bottom-up rather than top-down approach to influencing decision-makers. Throughout history, there have been a number of grassroots successes, perhaps the most well-known being those wins within the American Civil Rights Movement. The American Civil Rights Movement was no doubt one of the biggest grassroots movements, so much so that many grassroots movements today ascribe to Kingian nonviolence, a philosophy of nonviolent conflict reconciliation based on the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the organizing strategies that he used during the Civil Rights Movement.
Nonviolence, organized nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
And I'm always fascinated when I hear stories about the actions and disruptions that were so well thought out and coordinated during the Civil Rights Movement, especially since social media and technology that we have today didn't exist. Today, we have access to digital communication channels like social media, which allows us to mobilize a huge number of members in a way that could never have been imagined for Martin Luther King Jr. or Peter Benenson. Campaigns can go viral, increasing the number of people involved and forcing the powerful people and decision makers to really take notice. Since Amnesty International's humble beginnings in The Forgotten Prisoners, we have grown from a single office in Peter Benenson's London Lawyers Chambers to a global human rights movement of over 7 million people in more than 150 countries and territories. In a world where leaders and decision makers don't necessarily do what is right, a lot of power lies in the will and passion of the people involved with grassroots movements like Amnesty and the broader human rights movement. Amnesty wouldn't be able to bring about change and successfully defend the rights of others around the world if it wasn't for the thousands of personally motivated individuals all around the world who come together and bring their unrestrained passion and enthusiasm. We recently spoke to an incredibly inspiring and passionate activist from Townsville in far north Queensland, Peter Hanley, who has been an Amnesty activist for over 30 years.
Thanks for chatting with us today, Peter. We'll just jump straight into some questions, if that's okay. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with Amnesty International?
Yeah, when I was I just left university, I went overseas with Australian volunteers. It was Australian Volunteers Abroad, now it's called Australian Volunteers International. I worked in Malaysia and then worked in a refugee camp. So that took about, I was there for about, overseas for about 4 years. And so when I came back, it's sort of almost like culture shock. You realise that some of the things that you saw overseas, people here didn't know about and often didn't care. So I suppose that really got me started I call myself a community activist. I've been involved in a whole lot of justice and human rights causes over the years. Mm-hmm. I was involved in the 1980s. I worked for an organisation called Action for World Development, and as the name sounds, we were talking about third world development, but also talking about how what we do in Australia can impact on people overseas. And it was in the early 1990s I got involved with our local Amnesty group. I was one of the members of the group for several years, and I became convener probably around the mid-90s, I think. And since then, in 2003, I got involved in the branch committee, the Queensland branch committee, and soon after that, I became the branch president. I think probably 2005, and had several years on the national board, and come back, and now it's just still working in our local group here, and also back involved in the branch committee again. I'm currently the Queensland branch president. So yeah, it's been a long history and great experiences as an activist with Amnesty over all those years.
How do you think the human rights movement has changed over the last 30 years?
When I first got involved, some things are still the same. We focus on letter writing, but of course the IT scene was very different. I think the World Wide Web was probably just coming in around then, but we got all our letters, sort of our letter requests by post, and we'd meet and we'd write urgent actions, and our group also had what we call a case file. It was actually over the years of certain prisoners, they call them adopting. We'd adopt a prisoner. And we'd work really hard on that case, so we might be doing all sorts of different things that the international movement suggests might be helpful to get that prisoner released. So we're focusing then on, I suppose, on smaller targets. We didn't have such a broad mandate, Amnesty. Then we're focusing very much on prisoners of conscience. And over the years I've been involved, the mandate's broadened, and so now a whole range of human rights issues have become really important. But back then it was very much just focusing on the prisoners of conscience. Yeah. As I said, I think the whole change in the IT sector, social media, all those sorts of things have really changed the way Amnesty works and the way other social organisations work as well. It's an interesting term. I recently was at the National Annual General Meeting was invited to give a short address, and one of the things I picked up on was that back in the early days when Amnesty first started in the 60s, we were campaigning on behalf of prisoners of conscience. Mm. But the way things have changed now, there's so many different requests, all this information flooding us, and so almost we've become, people who are involved in Amnesty, we're almost prisoners of our own consciences, because that's what keeps us going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so easy just to get overwhelmed and just give up, but I think... thankfully, our own consciences keep us working on behalf of people who the human rights have been abused or taken away.
Definitely. What are some of the new challenges that human rights activists face today that they didn't when you first got involved with Amnesty?
I think it's very much that last one. I mean, someone once talked about we have this bombardment of the senses. You know, there's just so much coming all the time, and there's so many requests and there's so many good causes, and each day you've got to think, well, which cause will I support and which ones won't I? Because they're just, you know, I think I count some days 30 or 40 different email requests for different groups, and all of them are worthy causes, but what do you support? So I think the challenge is just to keep focused and keep working, you know, for particular cases and with particular groups of people who we're working with, and just to keep on keeping on, because I think the danger is just to, I think sadly most people in our community just think it's all too big and just give up on it.
Yeah, definitely. What advice do you have for any current or aspiring Amnesty activists?
Join a group. I think for me the most important thing over the 30 years has been my local group. You know, it's interesting, being in a smaller centre, we often interact and, you know, you might meet them at, well, a lot of my group were in a running club, and we'd meet each other each week at the running club. We'd be involved in other community groups, and so that group became really important. So you're working with each other, you're encouraging each other. If someone's feeling a bit low or someone's feeling a bit, that's almost despairing, we can go in and encourage each other. So I think the importance of the group is the group's so important. I think, you can sort of be an activist on your own, but I think it's very hard to sort of keep up the momentum because it's just so overwhelming, all the different causes we're coming across, and it's so easy to burn out. And I think the important thing is to have the support of the group, not to burn out, to keep on doing the work that's so important.
No, I really agree with that. What are some of the highlights or big wins that you've been involved in or witnessed during your time as an activist?
It's an interesting question. I thought about that. There have been a couple of really what I call big wins. I mean, David Hicks in the my years are all mixed up now, but yeah, it was in the 2000s. You might remember David Hicks was an Australian who was imprisoning Guantanamo Bay, and so Amnesty around Australia adopted his cause. We were very active in the Townsville group and working for his release. We actually started a weekly vigil we called Fridays in Orange, where we'd actually stand outside our local MP's office and call for justice for David Hicks. And that spread around to some other places as well, so it was quite a few regular vigils. So when he was released, that was a great cause for celebration, and Amnesty was very much part of that, securing that release. Before that, back in the 1990s, that is, there was the International Criminal Court, and that's been such an important development where the people who commit crimes against humanity, there is a court that can actually charge people and convict people for crimes against humanity. And the Australian government, after being one of the countries most supportive of it, went a bit cold, and you know, there was some reluctance on some Australian MPs to support the legislation because of the fact the Americans didn't like it. And we had a really great win. This is a local group with our local MP who had said that he wasn't very keen on it, and we got the facts to him, we lobbied him and met with him, and then he came around and was one of the great supporters of the International Criminal Court. So for a local group, that was a big win for us. But I think the real inspiring wins are those ones that, you know, they've been coming, there's been a couple later. There was Tala, the head of Amnesty in Turkey, who was arrested in Tala Church, and it was so wonderful when, you know, groups around the world came in on his behalf and he was released. And similar cases like that, where people around the world have, Amnesty groups around the world have been able to shine the spotlight on human rights abuse and actually get some outcome for the people who have been abused. So I think the good news cases that come in always is the big wins that we have as a human rights movement.
Amnesty has achieved countless successes, some of which Peter touched on, since our humble beginnings 57 years ago. For example, in 1972, Amnesty launched its first campaign against torture. 12 years later, the UN voted to combat torture worldwide with the Convention Against Torture in 1984. In 1977, Amnesty was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for contributing to securing the ground for freedom, for justice, and thereby also for peace in the world. In 1980, Amnesty launched its first campaign against the death penalty. When Amnesty started in 1961, only 9 countries had abolished state executions. By 2015, that figure had risen to 142 countries. In 1993, Amnesty campaigned for an international criminal court to bring those responsible for genocides and war crimes to justice. We succeeded in this campaign, and the ICC was finally established in 2002. In 2011, the Australian government introduced a national plan to reduce violence against women and children, thanks to extensive campaigning by Amnesty. In 2013, after 20 years of pressure from Amnesty supporters, a life-saving global arms trade treaty was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly and was later ratified by 99 states in 2014. And more closer to home, the Queensland government announced in 2006 that it will transfer 17-year-olds out of adult prisons and into youth detention centres instead, after extensive Amnesty campaigning. Not only has Amnesty been instrumental in holding governments accountable around the world, but they have also fought for the release of individuals detained because of their race, sex, religion, or political beliefs. Benenson called these individuals prisoners of conscience, and Amnesty has worked tirelessly to pressure governments for the release of these individuals. Some recent examples of prisoners of conscience that Amnesty has helped release include Peter Grest, Nita May, Pablo Pacheco, and Omar Deguez. Despite our successes, there's still a long way to go, and we need your help to fight for human rights around the world. If you would like to get involved, you can jump onto our Amnesty Australia website or contact your local action centre through their social media accounts.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this week's recap on the human rights movement.